Well, good morning. You folks, if I get in the way, because I'm kind of a walker and a pacer, I apologize ahead of time. My name is Tom Rosenfeld. This is Rachel Henderson. Today we're going to do Apple 101 for kind of to give you an idea of what we're going to be covering today. This is literally Apple 101. We are covering every aspect from the day that you think, hey, I want to start growing apples, to harvesting and selling your apples. That's a lot of ground to cover, so this is 101. We aren't going to be diving deep into any one area. We can certainly take questions at the end. We can get into some of the details, but we want to make sure that we cover everything, assuming that if you're coming to an Apple 101 class, you're thinking about growing apples. And so we're going to cover all the aspects. One other thing, this is organic Apple 101. We're not going to talk about conventional methods. I've never grown conventional apples. Yeah, so we don't know anything about conventional apples. If you're here for conventional apples, I would suggest go to the Canadian Thistle presentation down the hall, because we don't have any of that info. So we're going to talk about organic considerations for growing apples. So we're going to do a little introduction so you understand our farms and where we come from and our perspectives. And with further ado, let's start with Rachel.
Here we go. Okay, can you hear me all right? My mic on. All right, so I'm Rachel Henderson. We have Mary Dirty Face Farm outside of Menominee, Wisconsin. This is me and my family in our orchard. We started our orchard from scratch. We bought a hay field in 2008 and started planting apples from we started planting a lot of fruit. We're here to talk about apples. I actually grow more apples than anything else, but also pears and plums and a lot of berries. I do like talking about those things, but they're not part of this presentation today. But my contact info is in the conference guide, so you know how to find me. So we initially bought a 20-acre parcel, and then an opportunity came up to buy the adjacent 40. So we now have 60 acres. A little bit under 14 is fenced in for orchards, and most of that is planted, but in various stages of maturity. We planted most of our initial orchard from 2009 to 2014. I already mentioned this, a list there of most of the things we've tried planting. We've tried some more unusual fruits as well. I don't have a lot of great things to say about most of them, but I'm happy to talk about those too in another setting. And then in 2000, we were living in the Twin Cities when we bought our land outside of Menominee. It's about a half hour or an hour and a half commute. And we started out with kind of a 5-year transition plan. So this was one of our first visits to what would become our new farm, standing there in the field. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about the layout, about what would work in this place, about how to take advantage of the landscape that we had. It's a lot of rolling hills. We have a lot of woods, which is really lovely. So we spent mostly weekends out there for our first 5 years, establishing our orchard, establishing infrastructure, getting things ready. And we moved. Oh, that's funny. I don't know what happened to the layout there. We moved out permanently in 2014. And then we started establishing a second orchard block that's all apples. And this was a lot of lessons learned from our first few years in growing and selling apples. We figured out what are the things we want more of and what do we need to kind of fill out our season and our marketing plan. We've been certified organic since 2016. During those years, we decided to eliminate some of the crops that we were experimenting with. So again, this is about apples, but we did decide to take out cherries and grapes, among other things. And then since 2017, our planting has mostly involved filling in gaps, replacing things that needed replacing, and that kind of stuff. So we market in kind of three major channels. So I'll just talk a little bit about our marketing. The first is farmers market. That's how we got started right away when we had our very first crops. Farmers markets offer just a ton of flexibility. So it was nice when we didn't know what was going to, you know, grow, what we'd be able to pick. We'd take whatever we had to the farmers market and sell it. And we learned a lot along the way. And it's been a good experience for us. We kind of thought we would get into farmers markets and get our feet wet and establish other things and then get out. But we continue to enjoy being there. We have a niche product that does pretty well. We mostly do farmers markets in Minneapolis, so we're, again, about an hour and a half. It's kind of a long drive, but it's a worthwhile commute to get a pretty good market. There are drawbacks to farmers markets that I think most people in the room probably know. It takes a lot of time. A rainy day can ruin things for you, especially if it comes at the peak of berry season. And so we kind of think about how we plan our other market channels around that uncertainty and kind of know that uncertainty is there and how do we make sure that they, that we kind of ensure around that. So. Our largest marketing channel right now is a CSA model, FruitShare / AppleShare box. We do two different options throughout the year, one that includes kind of everything we grow, and then one that's really almost all apples with occasional other fruit in there. That's been a really great experience. We are kind of building the concept as we do it. You know, there's a lot of vegetable CSAs around, so we have been able to learn a lot from those, but the fruit share model is something that I think is newer, takes a lot of experimenting, but we're really enjoying it. It's been a good experience. And then our kind of local food co-ops and other small wholesale is our other biggest market channel. And this is where working with our farmers market, kind of they complement one another, right? If we have a pretty bad day, then I'm reaching out to the people who buy our fruit and figuring out those. Go ahead.
Was $3 a pound your price at market as well?
That's a great question. At market for our apples, we sell by volume. So you can see those baskets. So we sell quarter peck and half peck baskets. It's a lot faster than weighing out apples at market. So we've gone this way and we don't take a scale. We don't have to worry about batteries. We don't have to worry about any of that. And you get what you get. There are people who want to buy less than that basket. And so sometimes I'm negotiating with them, or sometimes I'm just telling them no, depending on how busy the market is. So, but the answer is we're getting a little bit. We're getting kind of $3 to $3.50 a pound. Kind of depending on the apple, how well, you know, how it packs into that basket, right, and the weight. Some apples are less dense than others, but we're in that $3 to $3.50. And so this picture, wrong way. So the picture you're looking at is a sale at the co-op with our apples. I didn't actually mean to show the price here per se, but of course you can see it. This is one of the benefits of working with our local food co-op is this is almost all our apples, I think, and our pears that they put on a big display one fall, which was really exciting. But that was a sale price. I think they're normally $3.50 a pound at the co-op. There's a lot of great pros to working with our local food co-op. But we also do a number of other kind of small wholesale channels. So we're working with local bakeries, other kind of food makers. We have a popsicle maker who buys a lot of fruit from us, other things like that. And it's a really great complement to the farmer's market, the uncertainties of the farmer's market. We do have The question is, do we have a cider press? We do. I'm not going to talk a lot about value added. Tom will talk more about value added. We do press cider. We sell kind of just direct from on farm. We don't pasteurize it, so we just sort of press it, try to sell it all as fast as possible, and not kind of have cider sales on an ongoing basis. We think of things like cider, and we also do some jams and jellies, as more like loss mitigation than anything else. It's not at this point like a major part of our business, which is why I don't include it in our kind of my three marketing channels. I will say one more thing about marketing. This is just some pretty pictures of my orchard that I wanted to share. The last thing about marketing is, you know, I think about those three channels as kind of like buckets. And every year I'm sort of thinking about like how full is each bucket? Where do we put our time and energy and product? And that has shifted over the years. For a while we were like, let's put more and more and more into the CSA bucket. And then I was driving all the time, and I was like, what if I take some out of the CSA bucket and put a little more in the farmer's market bucket because I'm already making that trip? And then, you know, last year, I put way more into that wholesale bucket than I had thought I was going to, and it went really well. So I'm, you know, I'm kind of always thinking about that, but I have sort of limited it to those three buckets. So I'm not kind of going in, going out looking for a whole bunch of new markets, but I'm always sort of thinking about how they go from bucket to bucket, if that makes sense. And that's home.
I'll take that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I'm with Earthverse Farms. We're in Southwest Michigan. So we're, for any Michiganders in here. We're down in the corner. We're about 15 miles off of the lake, and we're in that zone that goes all along Lake Michigan and Michigan. That's the, we call it the Fruit Belt. What we did is, so we started a little differently than Rachel and Anton. So we bought a 45-acre farm, had 35 acres of apples. They were conventional. These are all semi-dwarfs. These are widely spaced, kind of old-school conventional orchard. We put it immediately into transition. We did our first certification in 06, and we've been continuously certified since then. Over the years, we've developed into different areas, and this is going to be kind of a theme. We're at Apple 101. I think it's important when you're doing the beginnings of apples that you learn how to do the apples first, you learn how to do a manageable amount of apples first, and then you start to expand, like your question about cider. You know, we introduced cider like almost 10 years after we started growing apples, because it's in and of itself, that's just such a complex business by itself. We wanted to make sure we could grow the apples before we started figuring out how to press them. We also have other things, as Rachel, one of the things in apples, like any crop, you're going to do one crop, you're going to have a really rough time. So I assume if you're here and doing apples 101, you're either thinking about going into an orchard or you're adding apples to an existing farm. So we started out purely as an apple orchard. All it takes is one or two really rough springs where you say, what am I doing? I need something else. Now we're into a lot of other things. So we're a diversified fruit farm, all certified organic. This includes blueberries, peaches, strawberries, melons, watermelons. I don't even know if there's anything else up there that I haven't mentioned, but we have a lot of fruit. And the point of it is to diversify, spread our season, and lessen our risk only on apples. So apples can be good to you, but they can also be rough when you have that bad year. So that's where we are today. This is a picture of kind of what the orchard looks like. This is not a high-density orchard. This is not a modern orchard in any modern sense. No trellis. These are all semi-dwarfs. These are the things that we call Michigan standards, and you know, this is just your standard apples. It's changed over the last 18 years. You know, we have a lot more modern varieties, but this is what was out there when we bought and we put the varieties up there. You know, these are all your Bread and Butter, Red Delicious, Gold Delicious, Jonathan, Rome, Paula Red, Empire. I mean, these are great varieties to sell. They're not as exciting at the farm market as, of course, Honeycrisp. So if you're in here and you're thinking about planting apples and you're going to go to a market, you're going to be planting Honeycrisp and other varieties because that's what everybody's asking for. We started with this and we've learned over time. What we're going to talk about today a little bit from my perspective is what it takes to convert an orchard. So transitioning an existing orchard is a far different enterprise than planting new. Has its advantages. We have apples in year one. Has its disadvantages. Those are the trees. This is the varieties. This is what we have to deal with. Over time, we had to add quite a bit of infrastructure. So when we're talking about at this scale, we need things like what's listed up there. Cold storage, commercial kitchen, irrigation. These were all things that we had to add to our farm. If you're doing 10 trees out back to add to your farm market vegetable farm, you're not going to need all that stuff. You can get by with much less complexity, much less investment. But this is all kind of accumulated over time. To this day, all of our trees are in semi-dwarf. We have two orchards that we manage now. They're in two different places. It's a long story, but we have two orchards, and it's a total of about 50 acres, 55 acres of apples. We have planted new trees continuously. I think as an apple grower, you learn you have to always be planting. I guess that's like ABCs, ABPs, always be planting. So we have planted many new trees. We've never gotten into dwarfing. This year will be our first experiment with high density. I'm not convinced in warm, humid Southwest Michigan whether I'm gonna have any issues with high density. We'll talk about what that means. But we've stuck to the semi-dwarfs for now. And again, 2023 will be our first kind of foray into that world. You see the new plantings that include things like Honeycrisp and Fuji and Pink Lady. These are areas that we have in our UPIC area. These are the areas that people are at, the varieties that people are asking about. That's why we're planting them, not because we love them. I do love some of them, but that's what people are asking for, and that's what we're planting, is trying to stay in front. Apples, we always have to be thinking 3 to 5 years out. It's a little challenge for that. We used to grow vegetables similar to, you know, we have some similar themes here. Vegetables for us, vegetables and farm markets is a weekly game, it's an annual game. And as a perennial fruit grower, we suddenly started to run into a conflict between forward thinking and what's going on right now. You know, we have to go and get our tomatoes into bins right now because we have to get to market. But I have this spray that I have to do that's gonna affect me 2 months from now. You know, that conflict started to really become a problem for us. So we pulled back quite a bit on our vegetables. We license suppressed cider around 2015. That in and of itself was a significant lift. We can talk about that later. That's not really apples 101, that's apples 201. It just is pretty complicated to press your own cider.
To also add to that, it varies so much by state what you have to do to press your own cider, and that's another reason not to talk about it here.
So that's a good point. That's a very good point. The challenge we ran into, we decided to go ahead and press cider because we had no cider mill near us that was certified organic. So we were taking our organic apples to the mill and coming home with conventional cider. So that's why we went down to that route. We do other value-added products. Vinegar, apple cider vinegar is super easy to make. You just have to be a little neglectful. Found that out the hard way, but now it's a great product for us. We also make applesauce. We make cider syrup or boiled cider, depending on which part of the country you're from. The cider has become a significant part of what we do. It's something that we sell both retail and we've really been developing nice relationships with breweries, which buy in totes and large quantities, which really helps us. They turn it into the hooch. We don't do that. So this is kind of the areas where we sell. This is economically where our activity is. So we also run a CSA. It's a full fruit CSA. It was interesting. I didn't realize that we both run a full fruit CSA until we started working on this presentation. But yeah, so we do that. Ours is a monthly, June through November. Before we got into other fruits, we used to run an apple only CSA. UPIC, we run a UPIC. Labor Day through when people stop coming. Usually what happens is we get to about mid-October, there's a really nasty weekend at some point and people just stop showing up. And so we're just closed. We're really busy at that time of year anyway. So often what we do is we're open for anybody who wants to actually brave the conditions because we're out there working anyway. We also run a strawberry and a blueberry UPIC, but again, this is Apple 101. Wholesale, growing at our scale, we have to have a wholesale channel. It's nice to have a wholesale channel to deal with fluctuations in production, which again, we'll have in apples. Particularly, we'll talk about that. But so the fluctuation, you know, when our big years, we're wholesaling quite a bit, and our lean years, not so much. And then farmers market, we gave up the farmers market after the first year of COVID. We were like, okay, we're done. It was just too hard. It was too much work. And we didn't like the fact that we had no control over the market. In other words, we just showed up at market. We were subject to the whims and desire of every farm market manager and the rules they wanted to make and how people were coming. And it was at 2021, we finally kind of cut the ties and went fully into UPIC. And I'm pretty happy we did that. So we can talk about that, but we were also planning on getting out of farm markets in somewhere about year 5 to year 10, and it took to year 17, 16. So this is just a summary of how we both sell apples. So, you know, there's, you know, you can see here, we're both doing the CSA, we both do wholesale. Rachel is doing farm markets, we're no longer doing farm markets, we do a U-pick. And then the value add, as we discussed, we both do value add. Value add is a pretty significant part of what we do, and maybe less so at Mary Dirty Face. Okay, so that's us. So now you. You're planning on growing apples. You're planning on getting into apples. Before you do the inevitable, which is, I want to grow X. Where can I buy a tree that is this variety? You really need to start thinking. This is farming conference, not a horticulture conference. So we're thinking you're doing this commercially. The very first question you have to ask yourself is, where and how am I selling these apples? Because that's going to drive everything as you get into apples. So it's really important, as a farmer, you need to be selling, not growing. The growing will come later, but first, where are you selling? So there's some differences here. I want to be a farm market grower. Maybe you're already at farm markets. Maybe you just want to add a crop. You know, maybe your crops are more earlier in the season and you wanted to have something for later in the season. That's a great place to start, and good reason. Your volume, you don't have commitments. You can show up with whatever you show up with. You get immediate feedback. So, you know, maybe you think your apples are great and you can't sell them. Or maybe you have this like amazing apple that grows really well, but again, nobody's asking for it. You're getting this immediate feedback. Is this a hand, or are you just saying hi? Or yes. So our primary market is Chicago, and we're 100 miles. Chicago's really big, so 100 to 120 miles. And then we're also 20 miles from South Bend, and we're about 75 miles or so from Grand Rapids. And then there's some other markets there, but Chicago's really most of our market. If we could move the orchard 50 miles closer to Chicago, we would. Okay, so that's about farm markets. CSA, so we've been talking, we both are doing CSA, predictable income. So you go out, you sell, you know what you're getting for the rest of the year, you know what your deliveries are. If anybody's ever been in the food business, it's similar to like catering versus restaurant. You know ahead of time what you're going to do, and you can plan for it. It's not only a predictable income, it's a predictable activity. So we know when it's coming up to, ours is monthly, we know, okay, you know, better get all of our other activities done in anticipation of that monthly delivery. U-pick. So U-pick is a popular thing with apples. If you're going to do a U-pick, location, where are you located? Are you located at a good spot for U-pick? If you're out looking for a property, this is, you know, important. If you already have a property, well, you can't change that location. So you want to evaluate, are you in a good spot for a U-pick? And then marketing. And marketing is something that is really critical in the U-pick world. From where I am in Southwest Michigan, there's a ton of apple U-picks. You might be in an area that's a little more where you're out kind of on your own and doing your own U-pick. The marketing is going to be very different. And you just want to evaluate that before you plunge in. Other ways to sell your apples, sweet cider. Okay, if we're going to do sweet cider, what's your equipment? It's very expensive to get into it nowadays. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, it's state level, but generally you have to press your cider, you have to clean your apples, press your cider, and then you typically have to treat your cider. There are raw cider rules, but that's Apple 201. So to get into just the equipment alone, just a basic cider press of any kind of volume and a way to treat it, you're talking at least $20,000 at a minimum. That's used equipment that's small. You can spend, it's unlimited how much you can spend on a cider press and UV or pasteurization equipment. And then other value added. I know many small apple growers that get into things like apple jelly, apple butter, other things. When you're doing that, then you're deciding, if you're going to go into that, that's going to be a different variety than if you're going to farm markets. And then finally, wholesale. So if you're planning on going on scale, then you're planning on wholesaling. And by scale, I don't know, 5 acres? I mean, I think, you know, there's a cut at which if you're growing more than that, you're not going to be able to deal with all your apples by yourself selling individually in cases to customers. So, you know, the wholesale market, you want to think ahead of if you're going to be selling, you know, if you're going to put in 5,000, 10,000 trees, who am I going to be selling this to? What are they selling? You know, and when you get into the details in apple world, you've got juice apples, you've got processing apples, and then you've got fresh market. And so you need to think through what are you doing in the wholesale world, if that's the scale that you're planning on going to, before you start thinking about varieties. So this drives every other decision. This is labor, this is equipment, this is varieties, this is location. It's the type of trees you're getting. It's everything is based on how you're going to sell it. Now, if you're sitting there and you're saying, I don't know how I'm going to sell it yet, well, then start slow. You know, start with a dozen trees, 30 trees. Start really at a limited level and see what works best for you. You might love doing farm markets. You might hate doing farm markets. The same could be true for all of these things on here. Just make sure you know where you're going with them. When I'll tell my little story, like when I bought my orchard in 06, I had no idea, and we're going to get into details on this later, but in 06, I had no idea how many actual apples comes off of 30 acres of trees. And the thing about apples is, you know, they start here and they end here. And the amount of apples it takes that are this big to fill a bin that is like this table might be like two bins, it goes really fast. And so we hadn't thought through all of those decisions. Well, I mean, we did, maybe some of you might do this, but I did the same. You know, I was just like, hey, I'm going to be an apple grower, and just started without thinking through where am I selling. So scrambling to sell, you know, truckloads of apples in September as a new grower was, it's kind of dumb. So if you're planning on starting with new trees, you're going to start with your site.
Yeah, so backing way up from what Tom was just talking about, here we are. As mentioned, we started from scratch. So I've got just a couple slides next about figuring out your site and what's a good idea here. So in the upper Midwest where we live, our summers are humid. You all know that. One of the biggest problems with fruit crops in general, and apples are definitely included there, is fungal disease. I realized in the last, in Tom's last section, that I don't have a single slide in here that mentions the varieties we grow, which may have been a good idea to do. But we grow a lot of disease-resistant varieties, which is one of our biggest approaches to kind of managing pest and disease, is choosing the varieties that are going to just grow a little bit better in an organic system. And that's kind of like step one to disease management, is thinking about what those varieties are. Step two is thinking about your site. As I mentioned, bought this farm that had a lot of slopes, it had a lot of kind of microclimates, it had a lot going on, and we were thinking about where does it make sense, where are we going to get good airflow, where are we going to get good air drainage. One of the most sensitive points in the life cycle of an apple is the flower, and the flowers are blooming in April and May, and depending on where you're located, and we can still get killing frosts during that time. So frost damage during bloom is one of the biggest causes of crop failure for apples. And of course, it doesn't kill the tree, but it kills your crop for the year. And frost settles, right? So if you've got low places, if you've got places at the bottom of a hill, that's going to get colder and stay colder longer on those frosty nights in the spring. So you don't want your apples sitting down there currents sitting down there is fine. That has not been a problem for us. So we were thinking about those slopes. I'm sorry, were you asking a question? Okay. thinking about the slopes, those low areas, and how air moves through your farm. So we have really great western exposure. We get a lot of wind. We had to think about that. We planted taller trees on that western edge because we didn't really have a windbreak, but it also moves the air. You want to make sure that your trees and your leaves are going to dry out more quickly after the dew in the morning or after a rainfall, because you want less humidity sitting on your orchard. Of course, you might have a place where you really want to grow fruit and it doesn't have those qualities, right? And of course, you can figure that out too. You don't have to have a perfect site, but if you have a site where you have some options, these are the things to think about. A north-south slope is obviously preferable. Southern exposure, though, like really intense southern exposure, can encourage your trees to break dormancy earlier, right? So that they are potentially blooming earlier, which you don't want for the same reason as just mentioned. Yeah.
I think I misunderstood. Did you say it's better to have the windbreak or not? I'm still from the west.
Yeah. So you. Yes and no. I guess it depends. You do want some. I mean, it is good to have a windbreak if you have really intense winds, if you're really subjecting to winds, because the wind is going to knock the fruit off of your trees potentially. But it also makes it harder for young trees to kind of get their roots established if they're really getting jostled a lot by the wind in the early years. But it's also good to have air movement. So it's sort of the. I have some more pictures later, I think, that will show more about the layout, but. We did plant taller trees in the western edge because of that. But again, that's really specific to our site. And so this is what you're looking at. You're looking at where is this place, if you don't have infinite options, where is this place you're going to go grow fruit and what's going to work really well? How are you going to like best situate your apples in that spot? And so then you're also looking at what is the soil there. We bought a hay field, as was mentioned. It hadn't been tilled, which was, in a long time, which was really nice. The soil organic matter wasn't high, but it wasn't dead either. If we had started with a cornfield or a soy field, or we had started with something that had really been worked for a lot of years, I would have liked to have spent a year at least doing a cover crop if we could. That's not always an option, right? Not everybody can do that, but it's something to think about. It's a lot easier to work your soil before you have trees in it than it is after. It's a lot easier to spread manure into an empty field than it is to spread it between trees. And one thing we did very wrong, we had really calcium deficient soils because hay had been taken off over and over again. And we eventually decided we should spread some lime after we put the trees in there. That was not easy to do. It was a lot easier when we were working on our second site to have somebody come and just spread lime on an empty field. So if you have an empty field, be thinking about what do you want to do beforehand to give your soil a little bit of a boost. And there is a website here, Cornell University has a lot of great stuff on soil for apples and other types of fruit. I'm not going to go into details on soil organic matter or on soil testing, but it's good to know what you're starting with and see what you can do before you start planting. We eventually started doing with some of our rows of some of our higher density rows. So we have a variety of, I didn't mention this earlier, but we're mostly semi-dwarf trees, but some are bigger semi-dwarfs and some are smaller semi-dwarfs. Some are planted tighter than others. And on our tighter rows, we eventually started doing a year of cover crops. This is great. This is helpful. It doesn't have to be something that you really spend a ton of time on, though, or like don't think too hard about it, I guess, is the message here. We had a hayfield and we left our understory more or less as what was there because it's been a pretty good mix and tilling it all up, right, and kind of losing that permanent ground cover would probably offset, would be more detrimental than anything that could come from seeding it into like some kind of perfect understory mix. That's what that slide was about. Tom added that sentence to my slide. So I'm trying to, you know, we talked about intercropping. We haven't done much of that. We have, we have pear trees, as has been mentioned. They take a much longer time to come into bearing. And so depending on what you're going to be planting and what else you have going on your farm, it is tempting to think about using the space in between your rows. And if you're going to do that, thinking really hard about how they're laid out. We eventually, again, this is not apples, but we had started out by putting rows of currants in between our rows of pears, which worked really well for a while, and then we couldn't get a tractor through it. So, you know, we took out the currants. It was fine, but something to think very hard about in the beginning. And then variety selection. I will just say, I talked about this a little bit, but we do plant mostly disease-resistant apples. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering what kind of cover crops you recommend.
Yeah, so what kind of cover crops do you recommend? I'm not a cover crop expert, and there's a ton of information out there. It depends a lot on your goals. This is buckwheat in the picture here. If your goal is to build organic matter, it will be a different, you'll want different cover crops than if your goal is to like suppress weeds or do other things. And I don't personally feel qualified to recommend any. We've tried a lot of different things. We've used buckwheat and rye, peas and oats. I don't think I should say. I'm not a cover crop expert. But there's tons of resources out there. Resistance to apples. I'll let you go. Do you want this?
You can just wait. Okay. Just a couple quick questions or quick comments on the stuff about cover cropping, intercropping, et cetera. I kind of feel like I was remiss at the very beginning to just make sure you understand apples are really resilient. There's a reason that they grow all over the world. I think, if I'm not mistaken, they're the second most popular fruit in the world after bananas. They're very forgiving. Maybe if you're trying to grow a perfect, golden, delicious, organic in the upper Midwest with no scab, and no, maybe that might be a little challenge to make them like perfect, like they look like they're in some store or something. But these trees will grow. They like growing. They dig in the ground. They grab the ground easily. When I first started, I was so overwhelmed with like the cover cropping and the intercropping and the what do I do? And I didn't know, and you know, I didn't really know where to go with any of that information. We just didn't do it at first. We just kind of, we took over a conventional orchard. We had an understory. We just rolled with it. You did some cover cropping. We both have apples. So there's a lot of room here to kind of make a mistake if you know, or to experiment a little. Don't overthink too much at the very beginning, because you really need to learn how to grow apples, more importantly than some of the other kind of aspects of getting it to a 100%, or I guess the phrase would be, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Variety selection. So this is the question. I for whatever reason, I get a lot of calls from like beginning growers, especially in my area. They want to do organic. Oh, this is the only thing that they want to talk about. And so I'm guessing it's on your mind. How do you select a variety? There is some basics here. Again, this is 101, so we're not going to go into like, you know, those charts that talk about yield and the different rootstocks and how it does and whether you do straw mulching and just generally. First on market. If you're a market grower, whatever your market is, go find out what is selling. You know, if you want to do a U-pick and there's a really successful U-pick down the road, go talk to them and find out what they're selling the most of. Go to farm markets, see what, you know, farm markets are great feedback loops. So if somebody's selling a lot of variety X, their table will be covered with it. If they're selling very little of variety Y, you'll be able to tell because they'll have one little row and then they'll have a whole table of, you know, so they have Honeycrisp and Golden Delicious. So go check out your market and think through what it is. There's nothing wrong with a little plagiarism here. The resistance to apple scab, Rachel touched on it. There are varieties that are being developed that are, you know, resistant to apple scab. Apple scab, for some of us, you know, the great apple growing regions in our country are mostly, you know, Washington, which is like 2/3 of our market. They don't have the issues that we have with scab. scab, if you're going to grow around here, is good. You're going to have to deal with it unless you're way up, some of you real hardy types that are way up north, like, you know, maybe you don't have apple scab. Southwest Michigan, it is the scourge of our industry. Resistance to apple scab is great, but you still got to sell those apples. So we put in a bunch of apple scab resistant. We've since pulled them because we're not selling them, and I'm not putting the energy into those apples if I can't sell them at market. But if you're only doing a handful and you don't want to get into things like scab management, that's not a bad thing to look at. Seasonality. So as you're looking at varieties, pay attention to when they actually are ripe. It's really important to spread your seasonal out a little bit for your market, also for things like labor and equipment. You know, if you have all of your apples coming due, coming ripe at the same, you have a 1 week window, and in organic, we don't have many of the same tools that our conventional friends have about spreading out harvest windows. So when you're, you know, when all your apples are coming over, you're coming ripe in 1 week, well, you better have the people, the supplies, the equipment, like you got to be ready that week. Or do you spread it out and so you have some early apples, some mid apples, and some late apples? You're all growers, so I think you get that in other crops, but it also applies in apples. And then there's the timing, which is really kind of related to that. So we have timing of both of bloom. I don't worry too much about bloom. Do you worry about bloom timing when you're planting? Yeah, I don't. You know, there's all these charts. Again, you were an apple 101. So in apple 401, we could get into bloom timing and interplanting and making sure that you have the right, you know, varieties. For us, just focus on when the harvest windows are so that you can make sure that you've got apples at the time you need them, and then they're coming in the kind of the speed. The other thing I would just say, if you're selling to people, not only get a little feedback from them, but grow some apples that you're really excited about. Don't go too far into that because you're just you, but grow some apples that you're excited about, because nothing sells to individual people and than your own kind of enthusiasm when you're like, oh, you should try this apple. It is, you know, an Albemarle Pippin, and I only have 3 bushels of it, but it is an amazing apple and it's old and Thomas Jefferson grew it. And you're like, wow, that's amazing. If you have a little story behind it, it's a lot better than saying, I have 4 different varieties of Red Delicious. Which one would you like, you know? So just kind of get excited about it. I mean, this is, you know, it's work, but it's something to get engaged in. And so it's helpful for you to kind of be able to connect a little bit to the varieties.
I'm going to back up and just say one more thing about variety selection. This is a lot getting into the difference in market choices, but also the difference in scale, right, between me and Tom. So I say grow all apples you're excited about. because if you're, you know, for us, one thing that's really driven our variety selection has been our decision to focus on that like CSA model and thinking about the season, right? And so we start picking apples. We actually have some apples that ripen in late July. And how do we go from late July to the end of October and then keep doing winter kind of storage apples and have no breaks in between? And part of that is like good cold storage, right? And that will help us like hold on to those apples longer. But part of that is also like finding the things that fall in those niches. And like that might mean that you have a lot of apples that are unfamiliar to people. The beauty of that CSA model is I can put 4 apples that no one's ever heard of in a box and I can send them an email talking about why I like them and what are the best ways to use them. And now I have customers whose favorite apple is Laking, right? You know, it's something they've never heard of before they got it there. And the same can be true at farmer's market. You know, Tom talked about the instant feedback loop of a farmer's market, which is true. It's really brilliant. Like, especially if you have the option to sample, you get really immediate feedback. Or if you have the regulars, they tell you what they liked. But it goes the other way, too. And it's a great opportunity to educate people, to share that enthusiasm, to tell them what you love about Grimes Golden, but also to tell them why you're growing it and why it works in your system and why Fuji doesn't and why Honeycrisp is a beast to grow, and why you're growing these things instead. And so then people will listen to that. They love hearing those stories at farmers markets. Same with CSA. I can put that in my email. Only 40% of the people read it, but that's okay. and so there's a lot of opportunity to, on the scale we're at, right, which again is we're in this kind of neighborhood of, five-ish acres of apples total, to be doing that, right? If you need to do, and we have some that are just like market favorites, of course. And if you're doing wholesale, right, you do need to be thinking about, like, what are the ones that can just, like, go straight into your wholesale market, no problem, no questions asked. But thinking about, like, how you're going to market really does drive that. And I do like to encourage people to be brave on apple variety selection. Yeah, go ahead.
Wouldn't you add pollination considerations to this slide as well?
Yeah, so I think that's what Tom was getting at with bloom time. But yeah, so apples need more than one variety for pollination. I guess this is apples 101. We should have said that. But I think most people know it.
I think like
dyed. Yeah. There are very few apples that won't pollinize all other apples. There are some. That's something to get into consideration. And then bloom time can matter if you're really only growing two or three varieties. But if you've got 5 or 6 or 10 varieties, like it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Again, at this level, you don't worry about that. I mean, yeah. If you're just putting in a handful of trees, make sure you have multiple varieties. You'll be fine. We always, when in doubt, we plant a crab apple.
Crab apples are great.
And the question was.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do we consider bloom time? I'm being asked to repeat this question. Do we consider bloom time when, shouldn't that be on this slide?
Yeah, pollination.
And the answer is yes, in apple 201 or 301.
Okay, so now we're getting into rootstock. So we've talked a little bit about dwarf and semi-dwarf and trellising, density. This is where you're making those kinds of decisions. So if you're buying an orchard that already exists, you cannot choose your rootstocks. You're buying what's there. But if you are getting started, this is what you need to be thinking about. The biggest, the number one thing you're talking about with rootstocks is the eventual size of the tree, right? So what's called a standard apple tree will get to be 30, 50 feet tall. It takes forever to start bearing fruit. You're not going to get the top fruit. You don't want to be growing that in a commercial setting. It might be beautiful in your backyard, but that's not how you're going to sell apples. The smallest dwarf apple trees can't grow on their own. They need to be trellised. There's a great deal of labor and material costs in establishing that, but you can get apples in 2 to 3 years, and you can grow a lot of apples in a very small space, so there's a lot of positives to that. Tom and I are both somewhere in the middle. We've experimented with a lot of different rootstocks over the years. Most of ours are in the 40 to 50, maybe 60% of standard size. So that's the biggest decision you're making when you're choosing rootstocks, if you have the opportunity to choose your rootstocks. The other things you think about though are disease resistance. Some rootstocks are bred to be more resistant to, in particular, fire blight, but also other diseases. Those are going to be, when you're thinking about that, that's when you want to be talking to a nursery that does work with organic growers or has a sense of, of a non-conventional method. And then things like vigor. So even within a specific size, some rootstocks are going to produce a tree that bears earlier than others. And then some rootstocks have a ton of suckers. That's where you have like baby trees growing up from the roots. They can take a lot of time to prune back and to maintain. They're not great. And there's other things. There's a little bit of compatibility issues sometimes between some varieties of apple and types of rootstock. That's apple 401, I guess. I don't know. There's no perfect rootstock. Oftentimes you get what is available to you. So if you have a variety you want and you are finding a nursery that sells it, they may only offer it on one rootstock. Maybe they offer it on two or three. You won't necessarily always have, your perfect choice, although there are a lot of nurseries that will do custom orders if you have the time. That usually takes longer to get those. But
hey, Rachel, can I say two things? Just real quick, there's some resources down at the bottom. These are some of the charts. This gives you an idea of sizes. I don't know, is this online? Did they get to see these? How will they know how to get to that link? Okay, so there's some links down here and we can talk about that later.
But one of them is this. This is one of the links, I think.
That's one of the links.
So we'll look at that.
And then the other thing is ask a nursery. Mm-hmm. If you don't have to be an expert to plant 10 trees on all the different rootstock options out there. Just ask somebody who does this for a living, mm-hmm. Particularly on the rootstock.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and again, you may not have your pick. This graphic is a couple years old, but this gives you a sense of, you know, these up at top are some of the older rootstocks that used to be the fairly industry standards. Yeah?
Can you propagate your own rootstocks, or can you talk about that a little bit?
The question is, if you can propagate your own rootstocks, and can we talk about that a little bit? And the answer to the first thing is yes, and the second is no, because that's apple like 601. Propagating your own rootstocks is much more complicated than grafting your own trees on rootstocks you just buy somewhere.
I guess I'm kind of wondering, like, are there any patents or anything you have to worry about with rootstock or even Scion?
Yeah, are there patents we need to worry about on rootstock and Scion wood? And that is also yes. And that's all I'm going to say about that. So the ones at the top are older, the older industry standards. You'll still see these, especially if you're buying apple trees from like a garden center. You'll see a lot of those. The ones on the bottom are from the Geneva series, which is from a breeding program in New York. These are kind of more popular now. These are numbers associated with sizes. You can see again that seedling size, how big it gets. Most of ours are like in here. Our windbreak trees are kind of in here, so the person who was asking about that before. I don't know. That's all I guess we have about rootstocks. But yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
So what specific rootstocks are you kind of most leaning towards? G41
we really like. We have a bunch of, I really like G935. That's been doing pretty well for us. G30 is very good. I think we have a bunch on G222. That are not bearing yet, so I don't have a lot to say about it. I guess the bud series aren't on this chart at all. So the bud 9 has been a really big industry standard for a long time. That's in the dwarfing. That's down here, kind of at the G11. I will say G16. We had planted a lot of trees on early on and really didn't care for it. So that's, I guess, one thing.
Yeah. Are you staking those?
Yeah, so we actually stake all of our trees when we plant them. Again, we have a really windy site, so even when we're planting, we have some on it's not on here, but MM111, which is in here. We stake them when we plant them, and when we're staking those bigger trees, we're using something like conduit or things that aren't necessarily meant to be a big, strong stake that will be there for the life of the tree, but will help that young tree not get whipped around in the wind so much, reduce the risk of breaking. It helps it be able to really just spend that first year establishing roots. Most of our trees, being on semi-dwarf, we're staking with, we've experimented with a lot of things over the years and gone now toward what has become really popular in the Midwest, which are best angle tree stakes. So they are iron. Sorry, I'm looking at Chris because he knows more than I do. And they're like a right angle, like an L post. And they're very sturdy. They're very durable. They're fairly, you have to use a post pounder basically, but they're fairly easy to just install. And they've been they're a really, really good choice for kind of permanent tree stakes on semi-dwarf trees. Okay, so the PowerPoint slides and the detailed links will be available afterwards.
Another answer to that is if you have the app, you go to the details at the bottom on this presentation and the PowerPoint's already there to download.
It's locked, though. It's locked now.
It is?
I think anyway.
Oh, I downloaded one already.
Oh, all right.
Maybe if you register for the class saying you're going, you get the app.
Oh, but I didn't say I'm going to this class. Okay. Good to know. Okay, moving on to fencing. So if you are planting, if you are growing apple trees anywhere that deer are around, you're going to need to keep the deer off of your apple trees. They will, of course, eat apples, but the bigger danger is in eating the young growth. So in particular, if you're starting with baby trees, in the wintertime when deer are hungry and looking for food, if they're coming through your orchard space, they're gonna nibble at that succulent, delicious young growth and set your tree back to, if they don't kill it entirely, set it back to where you started. So the considerations for fencing are what your deer pressure is. And you know, we had, if you can remember back to the beginning, this open field. We have some woods, which is obviously a big habitat for deer, but we're also right on a road. And so we didn't have a lot of deer like crossing our field to go to the road, right? Because that wasn't like their path. They weren't used to being there. So I would say we had less deer pressure than a site where you had woods on all sides, or you know, woods and then a stream or a river. So knowing whether your site is a place where deer are already walking through makes a big difference, because deer are, you know, animals are creatures of habit, and if a deer is used to going through that site, either just to get from point A to point B or to find food there, then you're going to have more pressure. So depending on how much pressure you have, you know, there are different levels of fencing. Besides pressure, you want to think about like how much are you able to spend on installing that fence. Are you able to get some kind of cost share? If you really have a heavy deer pressure site and can prove it, often the state DNR will help pay for a fence. That's Apples 201, and it's very state specific, so I'm not gonna get into that. And then, do you want to install this fence yourself, or do you have the kind of funds and money to pay someone to install it? And then asking your neighbors again, how do they experience deer in the area? What do you need to know? How much do you need to worry about them? I have kind of the basic, most popular options listed here, from kind of cheapest to most expensive. We are in that fourth one. We have a high tensile electric fence, so we put that up before we planted anything. So we stopped the deer from finding out that it was a good place to come through and find food. They eventually learned that there's food in there. And occasionally we will get a deer that will get through our fence. But it's occasional. We have minimal damage. So it's doing a pretty good job. This is a picture of my husband installing it. This was one of the biggest benefits for us, is we could just do this ourselves. We didn't have to hire somebody to install the fence. We actually dug all of the corner posts in ourselves too the first year we did that, and that was stupid. So when we installed our second fence, we hired somebody to dig those in for us, but we were really gung-ho on doing it all ourselves when we started. This has worked well. So it's 8 wires. It requires some maintenance, but pretty minimal. We're tightening the fence almost every year. We're watching for one time we had a wire break. One time in like 12 years we've had a wire break. So that doesn't happen very often. It was a lot of work to install ourselves, but it was possible for the two of us to do it, which was nice. And then tree protection. So the other thing you're looking at is smaller mammals, right? In particular, rodents. Voles and field mice love to eat the succulent bark around the edge of a tree in the wintertime. And if they eat all around the diameter of a tree trunk, that will just kill the tree, right? Because that right under the bark is where the nutrients are going up and down. And that's really easy to do on a very young tree. When you have mature trees and the diameter is, 8, 10 inches, you don't have to worry so much about that. So hardware cloth is our choice. It's this woven wire. We put it around every single tree we plant. It's more expensive in the outset. I'll finish this real quick and then take your question. It's more expensive and more labor intensive at the outset than using a plastic or vinyl tree guard. But it doesn't trap in moisture, which is one concern with the plastic and vinyl ones. When we use the plastic ones, that I don't have a picture of, which is dumb, we take them off in the summer so that they aren't creating this really beautiful place for like borers and other insects to get in. So we can leave these up until they're, until the tree outsizes them. But it does take more time. And we buy them in big rolls and cut our own. You can purchase hardware cloth pre-cut for that, but it's more expensive.
So you're saying that circle of hardware cloth is going to keep the mice from crawling over the top or digging under and protect the bark from being chewed?
So the question is if that circle of hardware cloth protects from mice going over the top or digging under. You know, I have not seen mice crawl over the top. Our damage has come when the cloth has opened or broken, or if the snow cover gets above it. We are looking at kind of 2 to 3 feet for ours. We try to bury them in just a little bit so they're tunneling under less. But again, this is not 100%, but this is like 90% effective. And our problems have come when whether it's been opened or broken or damaged. Did you still have a question about?
I just wanted to know if the hardware cloth you're using is 2 feet tall or 3 feet.
Yes. So the question is our hardware cloth 2 feet tall or 3 feet tall? And we've used both, and we have we've bought out the hardware store over and over again when we're planting on what they have, and so we just buy what they have. But
do you like that?
I like 3 feet better. Although some of our trees, if they're branched, you know, you need to think about that, and we've had to fold some over, but yeah. Did you have a question about tree guards?
I'm not an expert, but the mice don't feed on the tree bark. The voles and the moles do.
Okay. Voles and moles feed on tree bark and not...
They cruise right around the grass area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they eat all the time.
Yes. So, yes. Thank you. Voles and moles are what feed on tree bark, not mice. I am not a rodent scientist or a mammal scientist. I just know there's critters. Yes?
What size diameter are you making that?
So the question is, what size diameter are we making that? We're cutting 2-foot sections and folding it over, and I'm not a mathematician, but that's what we're doing. Okay. Yes? The question is not a fan of ventilated tree shelters like
Plantra.
They're too expensive. Okay. I mean, if you're planting 10 trees or 20 trees or, I don't know, 100 trees, maybe. But they're costly. Okay, yes.
How do you keep them hooked together, or is it just folded over?
Yeah, how do we keep them hooked together? And it's mostly just kind of folded over and crimped, and then sometimes we take a little pieces like the coated wire and like twist it together. And sometimes you fold it, and we do a lot of different things. The question is, how do we keep them together, and however we can figure it out. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, Rachel?
Yes.
For that, there's a really nifty thing called the J pliers, and you can get it fairly cheap, and they come with these little pre-curved metals strips, and you just clip it around the part.
Yeah. There's a nifty tool. Donna has let us know there's a nifty tool called a J pliers. And I've tried it, and it's not faster than me doing it by hand.
So now we're here. So we've picked our rootstock, we've picked our variety, we've chosen our site, we've developed our site, we put our cover crop in, we've tilled it under, we've done whatever. We're finally now ready to plant a tree. So this kind of gives you an idea, by the way, of this is the work that you have to do before you are ready to start actually planting a tree. I'm just going to hit kind of some basics on tree planting. All of these topics, and we keep saying this, and there's resources at the end. All of these topics, there's great university resources for apple growing. You know, you've got Cornell, you've got Michigan State, you've got Minnesota, University of Minnesota, I'm sure Wisconsin, no slight on them. Pennsylvania, really good Midwestern resources. It's probably good if you're in this region to be using those resources. When you get out to the West Coast, there's, you know, it's a different growing climate, so it's just good to kind of, you know, lean on your universities. So row grid planting benefits. I want to just talk a little bit about this because I've seen this happen too many times. People get real excited. They put out 20, and especially, no offense, but the permaculture community likes to do the swales and the curves and things like that. Beautiful. Can't get equipment through it. And what happens is the trees get bigger, and now you have these big curvy things. And now you're trying to pull maybe a mower through or a pole blast sprayer, you know, rear blast, air blast sprayer or something. And all of a sudden you can't get through. And I've worked with a couple of people where we've had to start pulling trees because they got real kind of fancy. There's a reason why the rows and the grids are there. It makes your life a lot easier. If you're doing four trees behind the house, do them wherever you want to. But if you're trying to put in a couple hundred trees, you kind of need this row grid. Determine spacing. There's lots of charts on this. A lot of it is just driven by your equipment, your site, and what you're trying to grow, the size of trees, et cetera. Lots of resources on that. Now, once we've figured that out, now we have to actually plant the tree. We put a few different options up here. One of them, a shovel. You know, you can just dig a hole. And it's a pretty simple way to do it. I think everybody here knows how to dig a hole. It's not, you don't need any complicated equipment. It's very time consuming, and depending on your soil, might be very kind of back consuming. Auger, there's different types of augers. You know, the traditional like pole planter really isn't a great option for planting trees because of what it does to the soil, and especially if there's any kind of real structure to your soil, if it's kind of firm, you're gonna make nice, round, smooth hole going in. We were talking about, Rachel was mentioning that she's got an auger that kind of is tapered, so it kind of leaves the soil a little more loose in that hole. We use a tree planter, and not like the tree planter like foresters use. This is basically a plow. And we kind of set up, we're not really super complicated about this. So one of the things you do is like, how do you get straight lines? Which is honestly a question that a lot of people ask, which is how do you get the lines to be straight? What we do is we mark the edges of our field with our spacing. So we know how far apart the trees are in the row. We know how far apart the rows are. We mark them with flags going around the perimeter. We take our tree planter and we work the whole thing. This was actually a peach field that we did, but we worked the whole field, and then we run our tree planter one way, and then on the flags that we put out there, and then tree planter the other way, we have a nice crisscross. Then planting is super easy because then you just say, okay, everywhere that these two lines cross, plant a tree. That's one way to do it. If you're really good with a tractor, you could try to freehand it, and I'd like to see what your rows look like after, because you know, that look back when you're driving. But tree planters for us is the only way that I can see planting hundreds and hundreds of trees in a context of a commercial farm that has other things to do. Trees should be planted in spring. So I don't know why there's a lot of notion, maybe it's homeowners and things, about the fall planting. I want my tree to get in the ground. I want it to get comfortable. I want it to start, you know, expanding its root structure and things before the winter. I don't want to put them out in the fall. So generally, we always plant them in the spring. I'm just going to keep moving. Yeah. So now we're going to go through kind of the first 2 years and beyond for apples. And we're going to kind of compare contrast new orchard, existing orchard. So, and we're going to hit this, like hit and go. We'll take questions, but we're going to hit and go a little bit on this. I'll start with the existing and then I'll let Rachel talk about new orchard. So we've got what we think are the six primary issues that you should focus on. And I'm just going to go through it the first time and you'll kind of get where we're going. So water. Okay, so water, irrigation, you know, water. If I have dwarfing trees in an existing orchard, then yes, I need to keep providing water. If it's others, not needed. Trees are really good. Apple trees, semi-dwarf and larger, are really good at mining what they need. Mowing for weeds. We don't worry so much about the in-between the trees. We're just mowing the alleyways. And this is in year one. So again, if you're buying an existing orchard, you're going to need a mower. Training should be no need. I mean, if it's an existing orchard, it's been trained. These are existing trees. There's not much we can do for it in year 20. The support, if we need support, because I have a dwarfing that should be in place. If it's not in place, maybe you shouldn't buy that orchard if you have dwarfing trees that are not supported, because it would be a mess. Blooms, you will expect blooms your first year, hopefully, and you don't need to do anything to them. And harvest, you need to be prepared for harvest year one on an existing orchard.
One thing I just want to call attention to is the training on the new orchard for year one says not yet, and I missed that when we made this slide presentation. We start training our trees right away. So when we talk about training, just to be clear, this is like teaching the tree what shape it's going to grow in. We don't have time to get into detail, but the sooner you're doing this, the better. The sooner you're kind of like choosing your branches with a new tree that are going to become what are called scaffold limbs, and removing the other branches, the sooner you're doing that, the better your tree is going to grow. You want to make sure from the very beginning that you have what's called a central leader, so that main trunk growing straight up and being supported if it needs to be. And then making sure you want your branches to be growing closer to horizontal than vertical. And some varieties do that incredibly well. We have some varieties, like Liberty is one, that need almost no training because they just want to grow in this like beautiful open shape. And we have other varieties that just want to reach for the sun. And that's something that we do start right away. So I'm sorry, that's my fault for not catching it. Yeah, and I'll just say about water, we have watered all of our trees in as we plant them, but only have kind of regular irrigation on the few like really dwarfing trees that we have.
Okay, so now we're in year two. So that first year, by the way, you're just getting that plant established. You're gonna see in year two, there's some other things to do on the new plantings, but on an existing, it's generally going to be just like what it was in year one. A couple of things, check your supports. You know, if you're in a trellised orchard or some kind of support, you do have to go out and make sure you're okay, that you got through the winter okay with that. And then the other thing is on harvest in year two, it's an existing orchard. Just learn from your experience on harvest from year one and adjust as needed, whether that means labor, materials, equipment, markets, but just adjust and learn from what you did in that first year. On a new orchard, though.
So yeah, on a new orchard, again, we talked a little, I didn't say anything about weeding last time. I think in those early years, Tom and I, in setting up this presentation, talked a lot about like kind of the return on investment in labor and what's worth taking the time to do. And keeping weeds down on your new trees in their very first years has a huge return on investment. And as they get bigger and bigger, you know, some people really do like to keep orchards with a very, very clear or completely mulched area over the root system, in particular with smaller trees. That can be really beneficial, but there's less and less kind of return on doing that as they grow. But we do hand weeding on our brand new trees. As time allows, of course, because it's really labor intensive, but we use a lot of mulch. So kind of depending on what we have, because we bought a hay field, we've got just tons of kind of like hay and grass to use to mulch those trees. It's not the best mulch for woody perennials, but it does keep weeds down. And especially in the early years, we do that. And we bring in loads of wood chips. If you are looking at certified organic, you want to think about, you have to be kind of careful about where your wood chips come from, if they're coming from off farm. And that's all I'll say about that for right now. But we do bring in loads of wood chips to mulch our trees as well. Yeah.
So what about a living mulch underneath the tree?
Yes, question is about a living mulch underneath a tree. I didn't mention this in those early slides, but we do a lot of, as our trees start to mature, right? So in the beginning, we're trying to keep grass, keep everything that's competing with the root system down with that mulch, and then we stop trying so hard. I have planted a lot of comfrey in our orchard, and that's a controversial thing to do, but I don't regret any of it. It's a really nice living mulch. It will never, ever go away if you plant it, so I'm not advocating it per se, but I'm not sorry either. There are other things you can use for living mulch. I'm not an expert. But thinking, again, this goes back to the slide earlier. You could spend tons of money and tons of time and tons of effort on making sure you have this kind of perfect ground cover under your trees. And it might not produce better apples than if you didn't. So I guess it kind of depends on the amount of space you have and what you like to do. I like to go out in the spring and transplant comfrey. Like, I think that's kind of fun to do for a couple of hours. I planted a bunch of mint under my trees to try to repel things. I don't know if it works, but I don't regret the time I spent doing it. So, you know, there's a lot of these things that you can get into. They probably don't result, like, they don't pay off necessarily. But if it's something that's interesting to you, it's definitely fun to get into.
Okay, so now we're into year three. One of the things to point out, year three and beyond. So if you're doing a new planting, you're in year three, things start to get more normal. One of the things that we didn't talk about, but just to know, year one and year two on your new planting, you're not harvesting any apples, you're knocking blooms off. You need to let that tree grow and get strong before you start harvesting any fruit. I would say, you know, from at this point, we don't need to water unless we have dwarfing. The mowing continues. Like, these start to now kind of merge, these two.
Yeah, and I'll just say, with year three and a new orchard, and, you know, whether or not you're letting your trees crop, this is going to depend a lot on the size of tree you have, on the type of rootstock, also on the health of the tree you have in the orchard. So we've planted trees that by year three just... because we got poor stock, because it was in a weird location, because of whatever, don't look great. I'll keep taking bloom off to let that tree be healthy.
Okay.
And there's trees that we've let have a couple apples at year two because we really want to eat the apples, and they look great.
We're going to touch very lightly on pruning. Pruning is a lifelong kind of effort and goal. We want to make sure you should be pruning every year. If you really want to get into detail on pruning, if any of you were in David Sliva's pear thing yesterday, it's I forget the name of the course, but it was a workshop yesterday. He really put on a masterclass in how to prune. It was for pears. Really 85% the same for apples. Go look up his presentation, because he's got all these great, you know, different pruning systems and the pictures with the red arrow and the, you know, the showing the cuts and things like that. And I was really happy to see him do that, because we had chosen not to go into detail on pruning. So he did that for us. So go look at his. Just know you're going to do it every year. It's something you're going to do in the winter. Usually this time of year is when you're out pruning. And, you know, there are, when you get into, I just don't want to get into it, because when you get into, like, detailed high-density systems versus a semi-dwarf, it's like we're talking two different things.
Maybe how many minutes or hours a tree, or minutes, just so people know if they're thinking about it?
Sure. The question was, how many minutes or hours per tree, so that people know what they're talking about? I'm going to talk about semi-dwarf, because, again, when you get into high-density, there's just different ways you can prune that go much faster. Somebody who's really good will do that. Like, those size trees will take about 10 or 15 minutes. That's somebody who's pruning for a living. For the rest of us, if you're just somebody who's just pruning your orchard, those kind of trees are probably somewhere in the 30 to 45 minute, maybe 30 minute range. So, but we got guys that can do like 10 trees an hour, and it's incredible. So, okay. Now we're just going to keep moving. We're into thinning, and we're going to talk a little bit about thinning. And what we're talking about, thinning versus pruning. Thinning is the apples, pruning is the tree. So I could roll with that. So once your trees get going, just see, this is what you need to know. You need to thin. When we do, there are different techniques in organic systems that have been experimented with. I don't do any of them. This is like dormant fish oil, sprays and things. Thinning occurs at bloom and at fruit set. If you're a conventional grower, you're generally doing them at bloom. There are some techniques for organic growers to do it. I don't think any of them have been tested properly. I don't think there's really good data that show that they work. So you want to go mess around with a few trees, great. The one way that we thin, and that most organic growers that I know thin, is hand thinning. So in our area, you know, our bloom is the first week of May. By the end of May, you're seeing, you know, what kind of fruit set you have. By the end of May, early June, you're hand thinning little apples that are that big. You know, you can see here, in fact, sometimes you're thinning as the bloom is still finishing off. The earlier you can thin, the better. It's better for a lot of reasons. It's hard because it's expensive to hire for. It's just brutal to take apples off of your own tree. And it's a wisdom that I learned early on, which is if you're going to hire someone, train them, turn your back and walk away. Because if you start watching people throwing all your apples on the ground, you're gonna say stop. General rule of thumb, an apple about every fist. I mean, that's just an easy way to do it. So you just have an apple, you know, you go down a branch. It gets really hard because they come out in clusters. And so you have to pull off, typically that's five if you've got good fruit set, and you're leaving one. And you're leaving the king, the one right in the middle. And it's just hard to do. It's hard on the soul. I'm just saying that.
Did you have a question in the back?
No. The question was, do we do any root pruning? And the answer was no.
Real quick about thinning, just because this is apples 101. The reason we thin, which I don't think Tom said, is that apples put on way more fruit than they can actually ripen and take care of. The tree can't take care of that many babies. And when you talk to people about, I only get apples every other year, that's how a lot of varieties kind of naturally go. And you can push them into an annual bearing pattern with good thinning. And I don't have any heartbreak about seeing my apples come off the tree, so it gets easier.
So so harvest. So now you've thinned. We're going to talk just like one slide on nutrition, pest, and disease, because honestly, we could do a whole OU on that. In harvest, in a new orchard, you got time to figure it out. You're not harvesting really until year three, so you got 3 years to think through how am I dealing with this. In an existing orchard, These are the items to be thinking through. All of them, not just one or two of them, all of them. You have to think through, how are you picking? What are you picking into? Do you have ladders? Do you have bins? The time to do that is in the spring or right after you purchase this orchard, not in the fall. And then cold storage, just a very brief concept on cold storage. Post-harvest, you just need to decide if you're storing apples and for how long. Okay, in a perfect world, you're storing them at like 34 degrees, 80 plus percent humidity. So that's not going to be, unless you have an apple cold storage that's designed for apples, you're probably not having that. CoolBot is something that a lot of smaller growers use. CoolBot is a drier thing, so you have to think about humidity and drying out the apples. Often it's the drying out that is the shortening of that shelf life almost more than temperature. The other thing is there are other long-term storage options. I'm not an expert. There's a lot of experimentation going on with removing air, you know, removing oxygen and doing other things. Conventional growers have a chemical that they throw out there on their apples to put them to sleep, and we don't. Okay, nutrition, pest, and disease.
So this has been an OU, and we're going to do it in like a minute and a half. As mentioned before, apples have growing fruit in the Midwest. You're going to have a lot of disease, a lot of fungal, mostly fungal disease, and a lot of bugs. The good thing about apples as compared to like cherries or currants or something like that is there's just a ton of research and there's a ton of information. You can find out a lot about the life cycle of all of these top most common apple pests, and you can find great guides. And we have a resource slide coming up here that has great visual guides for identifying the bug itself, what it does to the leaves, what it does to the plant, and when you can see it. And so just, especially if you're starting from scratch and you have that time, like getting yourself familiar with what those bugs look like, what their damage looks like, and then the basics. We could talk again all day about how to mitigate them. With organics, there's a lot of what you're doing first is thinking about what are the cultural practices that help reduce the spread and reduce the risk of damage. And then you're thinking about If we get past that, what am I doing to kill the, or deter, otherwise deter those bugs?
And we can answer questions after.
Yeah.
On any, that specific thing that you have that in, as on your trees that you wanted to find out about.
Yeah, and I guess one more thing about nutrition. The reason nutrition is on this slide, linked with pests and diseases, is because for a lot of fruit growers, we're using foliar nutrient sprays as the main way of getting nutrients quickly into the tree. So we talked about like soils. We do spread some compost. We do other things for like soil nutrition. But if you have an apple tree that's deficient in calcium and you put lime or calcium on the soil, it's going to take years for it to get into the apple itself. And if you put it on the leaves, it's going to help the crop that year.
Okay, cool. So we're coming around the corner. We're going to talk a little bit about equipment here at the end. Rachel has a great way to say this about your equipment.
Spend your money where you spend your time. So when we started from scratch with nothing and we planted 100 trees our first year and 200 trees our second year, we were using almost entirely hand tools. And we were learning as we went, what is the biggest pain in the butt? What do we need to free up our time for? What can we do by hand and what can we not do by hand? And investing in the equipment that saved our time. Doing it that way, which isn't necessarily something I recommend, allowed us to really know what we needed to spend money on. So that's mowing, that's plowing, that's spraying, that's other things.
Spraying, we just need to kind of dispel that fantasy that maybe some of your customers, some of our customers have. I mean, organic, you know, is no spray, right? Like, you don't spray your apples. No, we spray our apples much more than our neighbor, conventional neighbors spray. So you need to think about your sprayer because you're going to have to get material on that tree. We put some examples. This is kind of by scale. So if you only have a handful of trees or whatever, 20 to 30, use a backpack sprayer. And
especially, you know, when they're babies.
You can get right up on top of them. Your mid-size sprayer, then you move to like an air blast sprayer. This is on the back of a tractor. This is, now you're into a large enough tractor to power your sprayer. And that's when you're, as again, when you're kind of over a couple hundred trees or so, you really need to start thinking about kind of that sprayer. Mm-hmm. And that's when the money starts going up. On a larger orchard, most important early investment. It's literally the only piece of new equipment we ever bought on our orchard was our sprayer. And it's still working, so it's good. Tractors, similar concept here. You got to match your tractor to your orchard and to what you're going to need it for. So here, like a 400-gallon air blast sprayer, that's the big sprayer. That needs a 75 to 100-horse tractor. And kind of like to have an enclosed cab because you care for yourself or your employees. If you're not doing that, if you're doing a backpack sprayer, maybe you can just get by with an ATV or something. And if you're something in the middle, then get yourself a middle tractor. Just size your equipment to what it is that you actually need it to do. Another thing that when we're going to talk about mowers is when you get into flail mowing, organic growers love flail mowers, you're going to need a little heavier tractor. Flail mower really, you know, it'll take a light tractor, and it doesn't work well on a light tractor. Do you want me just to roll with mowers? So flail mowers are really useful. We use them for chewing up all of our pruning, not the big cuts, but the small cuts. There's a lot of good reasons for that. We like the way that it cuts our grass better, too, than a rotary mower. Now, if you have a rotary mower, that cuts grass, too, and life is good with that. But this is... You know, the flail mower is kind of like if you're starting from scratch, that's where I would go. The other thing is...
We have both, and it's nice to have both.
We have both in what?
It's nice to have both.
And it's helpful to have an offset mower. So when you plant those little trees and they're all like right in a row, you're like, why do I need an offset mower? Just wait till they're like out here, and then now you've got branches out into your rows. Mm-hmm. Nice to have a mower to get up underneath those trees.
Tom, just a second. So we are at noon. I
got you. So we are at noon.
This is it.
This is the last screen. This is the second to last screen. These are resources. They're all available. They're all downloadable. Super helpful stuff. And then we just wanted to make a comment here. I mean, Michael Phillips was a frequent speaker here at this conference. Probably if you're into organic apple growing, you probably know this guy. If you don't have this book, go get this book. This is The Apple Grower. It's in the bookstore, Guide for Apple Orchards. Michael, unfortunately, passed away last year, right after Moses. It was February 27th. He was just a great sharer of wisdom, and his books are beautiful to read. They're not necessarily for commercial, large scale, but they're amazing for the concepts on what they impart. And so we'll miss Michael.
Yeah. Let's just leave it on the resources page. Yeah, so people can look at that.
So okay. Here's the resources page. Thank you for coming. Yeah. We'll stick around for individual questions. Thank you. I don't know why.